We'd all love the perfect conditions, but if you wait for them, you will wait and wait and wait, and pretty soon it'll be over.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Austin Kleon, a writer, artist, and speaker. Austin also speaks about creativity for organizations such as Pixar, Google, South by Southwest, and many more. He's the author of the well-known book Steal Like an Artist and Newspaper Blackout, amongst others, including the one we discuss here, Keep Going, 10 Ways to Stay Creative in Good Times and Bad.
Hi, Austin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you on. I've admired your work for a long time, but your latest book is called Keep Going, 10 Ways to Stay Creative in Good Times and Bad. And we'll get to that in just a second, but we'll start like we always do with a parable. In the parable, there is a grandfather talking with his grandson. He says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other's a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks about it for a second. And he looks up at his grandfather and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
You know, it's very dualistic, which I like. And, you know, we have bicameral minds, so it's kind of impossible not to think in dualities. But for me, I think the wolves both have their place for me. Well, what I try to do is, I don't know that I starve the dark wolf so much as I sort of follow where I'm trying to take the metaphor. I don't know any wolves in my life, but you know, I think about the parable. I'm like, where does the wolf go at night? Where does he feed? Because wolf, that's kind of a funny parable, because you don't really feed wolves, they're wild.
Yes, it's been told as dogs before also.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So if we switch it to dogs, it's like dark dogs, you know, dogs track things and they run around. And one of the things I feel like I try to do is I try to feed my light wolf with things from the dark wolf. Or I try to, you know, I try to pay a lot of attention to the dark wolf, because I think the dark wolf gives me information. So I'll put it another, if you want to use another metaphor, I think a lot about poison and nourishment. So there's a lot of poisonous things that I find in my life, you know, like something like jealousy. Let's just take jealousy. Mm-hmm. Jealousy is a very poisoning thing. But jealousy as a feeling is also just information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can kind of like hold your jealousy and kind of like look at it like an object and kind of spin it around, figure out where it's coming from. Sometimes jealousy shows you something that you want,
yeah,
or something that you're lacking. So then you can kind of think, okay, well, here's the poison. What's the nourishment? I'm someone who's driven a lot by disgust and anger. I get angry about the world and I get disgusted by things I see. But then I take that information. I think, well, what would be the opposite? So what's the antidote to this poison, or what's the nourishment? And then that's what I try to put in my work. And so when people say, you know, your books are so helpful, or they're so upbeat, or that's what I'm going for, but I don't think people understand how dark the books begin, like how all the books come from that dark wolf, right?
Yeah.
How all the books come from the dark wolf, and then the other wolf is the one I send into the world to greet people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah,
I think that it's about really looking at the wolf, really listening to its growl, seeing where it goes when no one's looking.
Yep, yep.
And then figuring out how to spin it. So that's where, like, it's taken me years to figure this out, but a lot of my really good work has to come from a deep place of agitation. Like, I like to think of my work as being fairly positive and nourishing for people, but it usually has its origins in something very kind of dark or ugly or painful.
Yeah. Well, you say it early on in this book that, you know, you wrote this book because you needed to hear it. And my experience is that the people often who have the greatest wisdom to offer are the people who have earned that wisdom the hard way, usually, because it's something that we've had to work through. I was talking with a coaching client about this earlier, and she was like, I just don't feel prepared to teach people about mindfulness because I'm not totally at peace. And I was like, the fact that you are applying it to the situations this difficult is what's going to make you someday a great teacher, because you're really practicing in real life with this stuff.
Yes. And I would also say that the best teachers, and I'm plagiarizing a writer when I say this, you know, some of the best teachers are the ones that need to learn the lesson.
Yeah.
All of my books are really the result of me not knowing about something. You know, that's the other thing about my books that I think people sort of misunderstand, is that, you know, the books come from me trying to figure something out. And then the books are the product of that process of trying to learn something. And then the books are really just me saying, hey, here's what I've learned. But then the other thing I think is really interesting is what you said. My mom used to be a guidance counselor, and she told me that every counselor she ever met really needed counseling. And so, you know, we're drawn to things in our lives that, you know, what we need, we seek out.
Yeah.
And then we become the kind of peddlers, or not peddlers, but, you know, we dish out what we found or what we've looked for. You know, the dualism that you're talking about, one of the reasons I love this idea about the one you feed is we're in a time and a culture right now where you have to pick one side, where it's like, it's very like, we're not really good as a culture right now with ambiguity. We're not very good with people who have one foot in and one foot out. So, for example, it's very hard for people to process the idea that an artist might be able to make beautiful or useful things and not be very beautiful or useful in their everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're having like this cultural moment where if we get information about the artist that contradicts the art, all of the sudden, it's supposed to destroy the art. Whereas I've always been someone who, you know, the people I really looked up to when I was younger came from really dark places. And, you know, they were not perfect people in their everyday lives. And they did cause a lot of suffering, maybe, or chaos in their everyday life. The good thing about the culture now is that we don't celebrate that. We were getting away from that narrative that you have to be destructive in your personal life in order to be creative in your work. But I also think there's a way that that can go too far,
right,
where we start dismissing the work of people that aren't perfect in their everyday lives. And so I think it's very tricky, and it's a balance right now. And again, the reason I love The One You Feed is that if you think about the culture and you think about, you know, human civilization throughout time, it's usually just balancing back and forth between the forces. You know, it's just like things get caught out of whack and things swing back and forth, and it's really just the pendulum.
That's right.
Or if you want to think of it the other way, it's like the big wheel that turns.
Yeah, I love what you said there. I mean, I think almost certainly anytime we correct something, we almost always overcorrect. You know, it's almost inevitable that we swing way over to one side, we swing too far back over to the other, and then maybe there's a little bit of a balancing over time.
Exactly. It's like when you're driving, you know, they tell you when you're driving not to swerve too fast because in the swerve, you get the whiplash and you go too far over, you know? So it's like, I'm not advocating for any kind of like mushy, you know, wishy-washy path, but it is interesting to watch these forces come and play. And the nice thing about staying alive, which I know you and I are both interested in.
Yeah, very much.
The nice thing about staying alive is you get to see those swings, and that's where the wisdom comes from. You know, you start seeing all the swings, and even in your lifetime, and you can see a way through it.
It's one of the reasons that I most wish I could live to be like, you know, 10,000 years old, is just to see how it all goes. You know, when people ask that question of like, if you could sit down with anybody in history, who would it be? I'm always like, can I flip that and sit down with somebody 10,000 years from now to tell me what has happened the last 10,000 years? Because I really want to know.
I'm curious. I mean, like, I always loved, I think it's Seneca, one of those old, you know, thousand-year-old writers who said, you know, when you read old books, you get to annex their lifetimes.
Yep.
So that, to me, is always the value of reading, is that if you can go back far enough or read enough people, you sort of accumulate the 10,000 years.
Yep.
It's just on the other side.
That's right.
Of history. As much progress as we make, you know, I'm always shocked at how much life stays the same, you know, especially when you're reading about, you know, people a couple thousand years ago. It's always amazing to me how it's still a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, underline all of it, there is still the very basic human tendency to want to be happy and want to avoid what makes us unhappy and to want to care for the things that we love and avoid the things that we don't love. And in some ways, that core never really changes.
Love and death.
Yeah.
It stayed true, you know? And I think that's why whenever I look into the future, I think a lot about the pandemic and how the pandemic, rather than changing life, has felt to me a lot like it's turned everything up to 11. You know, like they say in Spinal Tap, it's just like everything gets turned up, you know?
Yep,
everything's just cranked up and amplified. And so some of the really good things are even better now. And then the bad or annoying things are even worse. I feel like the future to me looks a lot like the past. Just, you know, I think that maybe just amplified. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a long-term pessimist, short-term optimist.
Nah.
I really feel like, you know, in the end, we're all doomed. But I'm very optimistic about the day. I'm very optimistic about what you can give with the time that's in front of you that you can sort of manipulate.
I might be a medium term something, but I don't know what. Anyway, let's move on to the book. There's a part early in it that you say, everything got better for me when I made peace with the fact that it might not ever get easier. You were talking about creating art in that sense, but I think we can apply it to living. Why is it helpful? Why is it good when we make peace with that, when we stop waiting for things to get easier?
You know, I think a lot of this came from being a parent, because when my kids were younger, I thought, God, if I could just get them out of diapers, you know, or then if I could just get them walking, or whatever, you know, whatever. And suddenly I realized, like, oh, it doesn't get better. It just changes. Everything changes, you know. And the minute I stopped worrying about when it was going to get better, I just, like, sort of enjoyed the now. Most of the great philosophical texts or the, you know, spiritual texts tell us that be here now, you know.
Yeah.
But I think for art and creativity in particular, it just, you just harness whatever skills you have, whatever materials. It's very punk rock for me. It's very much like what's in front of you, what abilities you have, what techniques you have, what tools you have. You use them right now in the here and now. And I will say that I've been extremely influenced recently by this book that I read that's not very well known and it's out of print. It was by this guy named Joseph Meeker, and he wrote this book called The Comedy of Survival. And Meeker studied two things. He studied literature and he studied ecology. And what Meeker sort of did is he talked about how much ecology mimics comedy. That if you think about animals and the natural world and plants and stuff, there's so much adaptation going on. There's so much improvisation that's going on that, you know, nature almost resembles a comedy more than a tragedy. And what Meeker said is that Western civilization runs on tragedy. This idea that there's a great person, you know, like our dominant narratives are, there's a great person and they have a vision and they mold the world into their vision, you know, and they change things. And of course, in a tragedy, it all ends in blood. You know, I mean, it's always, there's always some tragic flaw, something that brings the person down in the end. And, you know, in a comedy, it's usually about normal people that sort of, they struggle, but they adapt and they stay flexible and they're improvisational. And at the end, there's a wedding or there's a celebration, you know, there's drink. And Meeker's point was just that if we're to survive as a culture, it's going to take a comedic perspective. It's going to take a kind of flexible, improvisational approach to life. It's funny because I read that book after I finished Keep Going. Well, Keep Going, of course, starts with another modern parable, which is Groundhog Day, the movie Bill Murray's in where he wakes up every day and relives the same day. And I thought it was really funny how here's this book that's super influential on me like 2 years after I read this other book, or a year, or whenever. But I was already influenced by comedy. I just didn't have somebody, you know, kind of showing it to me. And so I think, you know, for me, it's just more about seeing myself as a comic character, as more of a, not a Buster Keaton, but a, or a Charlie Chaplin, but, you know, more just like a guy who's doing what he can with what's in front of him, you know, and being flexible and not having too lofty, you know, just being flexible and adaptive and learning. To me, that's just been like terrifically powerful. And that's when you don't expect things to change. And that was Meeker's great point, is like, if you don't expect the world to change, then you work with what's there. And it doesn't mean that you're complacent. It just means that you work with what's in front of you and you try to make something out of that. You don't wait for the right conditions. This is what you've got. And I think that what I just said has really been, I think, the real message of my work, I hope, for readers is that, you know, we all love the perfect conditions, but if you wait for them, you will wait and wait and wait, and pretty soon it'll be over.
There are no perfect conditions. And, you know, my son just last year graduated college. So I've been through.
You're on the whole other side.
but I related with everything you said. And I got better, like you, at going like, let me just try and enjoy this scenario and try not to worry too much about the next milestone. And looking back now, I'm like, well, the worry never totally goes away, or the care. Maybe that's the better word. You know, the care is obviously always there. I'm not too much of a worrier in general. We had Rainn Wilson on the show, the guy from Office, and he talked about something that I don't think he created this, but I love it. It's this if-then thinking. If this, then, but in the negative sense, if I just had this, then I would do this. And you kind of talk about this at one point in the book. You know, we think if we had the perfect art studio and we ran around with the right crowd of people and we had all these things, then we'd be able to be creative.
Yeah, that's like a computer programmer type logic on steroids type thing, if-then statement.
Yeah.
That's literally how computers run. It's like, if this condition's true, do this. And life just isn't really like that, you know? It's not that linear. It's not programmed that way. You know, my wife says something beautiful that I love, and there's several pieces of fiction that kind of play with this idea. But she said, you know, just once in a while, I'd like to live my life out of order. You know, I'd like to live a day where they were babies, and then I'd like to live a day when they were in their 30s.
Yes.
Or, you know, of course, you know, the whole meaning of life would deteriorate if you got to do that. You know, I mean, it's really the fact that you have to live it in order that provides. There's a great book about this, actually. There's a book called Some by David Eagleman, and it's Tales of the Afterlife. He imagines all these different afterlives. And one of them is that you have to live your life in a different order, but it's like, okay, here's 9 years of you brushing your teeth. Here's 2 years of you brushing your teeth. And then
here's great.
30 days of you making love. You know, it's just like, what's beautiful about the story is it shows you, and this is the thing about parables, as you know, is it shows you the meaning in your everyday life. You're right. If I did live it that way, it wouldn't have the same meaning.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be difficult to get the right balance in our social life. Do we need more contact with people? Do we need more time alone? This can be really challenging to figure out. And one tool that we can use for this is therapy. It can give us the self-awareness to build the right level of social life that doesn't sort of drain our battery. Therapy has been incredibly important to me in the past. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's really easy. I actually signed up for it again this week because there's something I wanted to talk with a specific type of therapist about for a short time. And so I went online, I answered what I was kind of looking for, what type of therapist I was looking for, the issues. It matched me with somebody a few hours later, and that person reached out to me like 30 minutes after that and asked to schedule an appointment. So it could not have been easier. So find your sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/feed today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/feed. There's such a common genre of writing, which is, you know, sort of letters to your younger self. What I wish I could tell my younger self, because that's exactly it. It's this sense of like, well, I just sure wish at that age I could have the wisdom that I had then, but it simply doesn't work that way.
No.
You know, I do think there are ways to help people as we're younger to be wiser, but a certain amount of it is you've got to figure out your own life, and it's going to have its own twists and turns, and that's part of the game.
Yeah. So I went through this weird thing recently where my book, Steal Like an Artist, came out in 2012. So it has its 10th anniversary next year. And so we've been working on the 10th anniversary edition. It's going to be like a hardcover. And I wrote a new afterword for it. And, you know, I had to really reflect on, you know, the thing I wrote in the afterword is more time has passed in between the me now and the me who wrote that book than the me who wrote that book and the person he was writing it for. Because I was writing it for my 19-year-old self, like, oh, what I wish I had known when the young age of 19, when I was like 27 or whatever it was when I wrote that book.
Yep.
But then there was this really interesting thing that happened when I was rereading the book. I thought, I couldn't write this now. And this is another thing people have a hard time believing if you're a writer, is that if you say that, you say, I couldn't write this now. They said, what do you mean? You were you when you wrote this. And I'm like, but I'm not that guy anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm not this person. And I love his energy. I don't know where he's getting it from.
He didn't have kids.
Yeah. I like his certainty. You know, I read the book and I'm like, yeah, this sounds great. Let me do this. But it's not me. Like, I couldn't do it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something I always try to tell young writers in particular is, you know, they want wisdom. And I'm always like, you know, sometimes it's really the idiot or the fool or the amateur or the beginner that really makes the leaps. You know, when you're younger, you should use your raw, nascent, gooey state to really play and figure things out, because, you know, the amateur has just so many advantages over the professional, really, and the expert. You know, a lot of my work as a creative person is trying to get back to that fool state.
Yep.
You know, especially in the self-help genre, everyone's like, oh, mastery. You have to achieve mastery. Like, that's what you need to go after and everything. And as a creative person, you know, of course I'm trying to attempt mastery and, like, I'm trying to put a sentence together. I'm trying to get really good at the craft and things like that. But it's really being able to go back to that fool state, that beginner's mind, where I don't know anything. That's where the really good ideas come from. And again, this is very influenced by being a parent. I have this idea of the curious elder. Because I'm approaching 40 and I'm starting to think about, you know, middle age and how I'm going to do this and the relationship I'm going to have with my kids. And instead of thinking of myself as like the wise elder, I think of myself as the curious elder.
Yes.
I'm very much like, you show me what you're into. You know, you're going to get the model of how I live from just seeing me and what I do and everything. But I'm going to be more interested in you.
Yes.
That's
beautiful.
You know, I'm going to be the curious elder and you're going to show me things. You're going to teach me. And that's sort of been my MO, you know, for a few years now with my kids. And I'm trying to, like, continue it. I'm like, what you just said, which I love, is that, you know, you could read all the books in the world. You could, I love, you know, reading. That's what I've, like, staked my life on, you know, like books and reading and wisdom and stuff. But at the end of the day, you've got to live your life. The experience is really what's going to drill it into.
Yeah.
I love it. But for me, it's like professionally, the thing to do in my position is to be like, I know these things. I'm the expert. And today I'm going to teach you about creativity, or, you know, I'm going to sell you my whatever. And I really try to be honest with my audience that, you know, I can tell you what I know, which is, I feel like, a decent amount. But I would tell you that the things that are the most valuable to me are the things you have available to you right now. You know, like the things that are the most raw and pure and available, you could get tomorrow, you know? Yeah. And so that's part of the wisdom too, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so much of what you were saying in there reminded me of why I have been so drawn to Zen practice for big parts of my life, you know, that idea of beginner's mind and the sense that not knowing, you know, there's a phrase from Zen, not knowing is most intimate. It's the best state to have. And that same thing that you said there at the end too, which is that every bit of our life is the path. There's a thing I repeat. I don't know what it is, whether it's the four bodhisattva vows. It doesn't matter. But I say it, and it's dharma gates are countless. I vowed awake to them. It basically means everything is a dharma gate, meaning a path to freedom, a path to insight, a path to awakening. Every little thing.
Yes.
You know, one translation of it says, I vow to experience them. Which is a beautiful idea that, you know, like you're saying, whether it's creativity or growing wiser or whatever it is, we do have what we need here.
I say in the book, it's like ordinary life plus extra attention.
Yes.
And that's how you get the extraordinary.
Yeah.
Everything that feels ordinary, if you can just pay the right attention to it, it becomes extraordinary. And that's what all the great texts teach us, is that there's a different level of attention.
Yeah.
There are different vibrations, there are different visions that we can have. You just kind of have to poke beyond the surface of what's presented to you.
Yeah, I loved that chapter of the book very much. It's called The Ordinary Plus Extra Attention Equals the Extraordinary. And I just think that's so great. And it's so in line with, in the Spiritual Habits program I do, we have a module. It's called No Ordinary Moments. That's the basic idea. Like, you know, the way you make a moment non-ordinary is you pay closer and closer attention to it. And you and I both quote John, I don't know, did you say it, Tarrant, I think it is? You say attention is the most basic form of love that he wrote. And I've got another quote of his that I use, which is, to learn to attend is a beginning. To learn to attend more and more deeply is the path itself.
I love that. You know, attention is one of those things that the greats kind of get around to. I read a really great biography of William James, who, of course, said the famous, you know, my experience is what I choose to attend to.
Yeah.
I just feel like, you know, the reason to read old books, too, is that, you know, people think that there's some sort of, like, truth or progress that's, like, set in stone. And I'm always, like, fascinated when I realize just how much deep wisdom there is in ancient stuff. Like, for example, you know, in the old days, people thought that your eyes actually shot beams out. That the way that you saw things was that your eyes actually projected. It wasn't that light came and hit your eyes. It's that your eyes actually shone out into the universe and like a spotlight.
It's fascinating.
And, you know, you think, oh, haha, how funny. But I'm very interested in useful fictions. I'm very interested in things that, like, I guess this is kind of a pragmatic thing, but it's like, okay, what would be the behavioral result of that belief? And the result would be, well, you would feel that you had control over where you put your eyeballs, your eye beams. Where you shoot your eye beams is in your control, right? You know, if you think about light just hitting your eyes and that's how you see, that's a very passive idea. It's scientifically true. But if you think about your eyeballs as something that shoot out beams and, you know, you look around, then all of a sudden it makes you active.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm very interested in, when it comes to ideas, and this is why metaphor is so beautiful and history is so beautiful, it gives us these examples of images we can keep in our mind or stories we can keep in our minds that influence our behavior and how we're supposed to act.
Yeah, I love that. What are some of your favorite ways for deepening attention?
I like that. You know, I'm a writer and an artist and a musician. So a lot of the ways that I pay deeper attention are about just practicing my craft. So, for example, drawing. There's nothing easier in an artist's tool belt than drawing. It's cheap. It's something you can practice with almost anything. And it's something you can do your whole life. And the minute you sort of really look at something to draw it, then you really see it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you think you know what a lamp looks like, but then really when you're trying to trace it with your eyeballs, you know, those eye beams again, you're like, wait a minute, this is much stranger and even more beautiful than I thought it was. You know, my friend Wendy McNaughton just gave a really good TED talk about drawing, and specifically she practices a kind of drawing that's blind contour portraits where you draw without looking down at your paper.
Mm.
And she practices that a lot. And that's something that I do a lot too. It really becomes a looking activity. So there's that. And then, like, it depends on what I want to pay deeper attention to. Mm-hmm. If there's a piece of writing that I really want to pick apart, I will copy it by hand or I'll type it out. And then I'll go line by line and circle it and look up words. You know, poems. I was going to mention before, the poets are the people who are really good at taking ordinary life and making it extraordinary.
Yes.
Like, so if you don't read a lot of poetry, I recommend it. You know, just start like reading, go to like poets.org or some online poetry website. They all have like daily poems or like daily poem newsletters and stuff.
Yeah.
People who don't read poetry, just, you know, start reading poetry every day. Just take 5 minutes. And that's a different kind of attention that if you're just, you know, if you're just going to work or doing your commute, so you're not paying that kind of attention that the poets do. So that's something. Close reading, copying, I do that a lot. And if you think about drawing as a form of trying to copy, you know, what's in front of you, that's copying too. Most recently, I've been pulling my piano back here. I have been blown away lately by how I can take a song that I've heard for 20 years that I've listened to over and over again, and if I sit down and learn to play it on the piano, all of a sudden it's a new song.
Yeah.
Like, I know how it works in a way that I never knew before. Some more practical things. Taking a walk. Taking a daily walk as a way of paying attention to your neighborhood. Like, if you drive somewhere all the time and then you walk it on foot, that is a revelation. If you walk a way that you normally drive, and if you drive a way you normally walk, you realize how much you're missing or not missing. And so I love taking a daily walk. Yeah, I'd say walking, drawing, writing.
Yep, yep.
That's pretty much my ways of paying attention. I practiced meditation for a little bit, and I like the way I feel. But drawing and walking are very meditative for me, as is copying. I think the most important part of my practice is every morning I keep a diary that's sort of like half sketchbook, half writing notebook. And I just fill like 3 pages, you know, like the Julia Cameron morning pages. I just do 3 pages in the morning. And I find that keeping a daily diary, if I do it right, and what I mean by right is if you just hold a pen and kind of start moving it and let things come out, you aren't just like, oh, what did I do yesterday? Oh, I did this. One of my biggest teachers is a woman named Linda Berry, and she believes really powerfully in this idea that you just kind of start making letters and things come. And she's taught me a lot about, you know, just kind of channel what you're trying to do with those morning pages or with your diaries. You're not trying to recount life as much as you're trying to, like, figure out what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not what went on, but what's actually going on.
Yeah.
You know, and I find that that morning practice helps me pay attention to my own life. It helps me pay attention to what I've paid attention to, too, which is, I think, is really important.
You dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
I'm an abysmal drawer. I mean, it's hard to, like, really look too closely at life when you're like, well, I've got a stick figure. But no, I sometimes try and look like an artist would look, like, where are the shadows? Where are the lines? Where are the shapes? Because it all of a sudden gets your mind to go from, as you said earlier, sort of passively taken in to sort of shining your light beams, you know, on something. All of a sudden I'm like, oh, because I think that's what artists are so good at doing, is saying, all right, off autopilot, study this thing. Another that is good is taking pictures.
Yeah.
There's a great book out there called Zen Camera by this guy. And it's about, you know, photography is a contemplative practice. And it's the same thing. When I'm sort of doing the practices in that book, it's like, as I'm out and about, my brain is engaging in a different way. I am paying closer attention. So yeah. I think art is so good for that.
Well, you mentioned, like, how you try to look at the world like an artist might, like seeing the shadows. And that's such a great point, is that, you know, my friend Rob Walker has a book called The Art of Noticing. And one of the exercises Rob suggests people practice is take a photo walk without a camera. So, like, you walk around and you look for good shots without actually having the camera there. And then what happens? Well, of course, you see a million things that you'd love to take a picture of.
That's awesome.
If only you had your camera. You know, it's funny, when I carry a pocket notebook, I have more ideas. And I don't think it's because I have more ideas than I do when I'm not carrying the pocket notebook. It's just that, well, now that's not true. I think actually having this in my pocket, sort of rubbing against my leg all day, the same way your phone, you get that phantom weird thing from your phone being in your pocket. I think having this in my pocket all day just invites things. You know, Thoreau said that, you know, your diary was like a nest egg. And we think of nest eggs now, it's like saving up for the future. No, there's like a thing called a nest egg, which is, it is a fake egg that you put in a nest to get a bird to lay another egg next to it.
Huh.
So he thought thoughts were nest eggs. If you write one thought down in a notebook, it'll invite other thoughts to come down.
Mm.
It's interesting how much when you read, because I love reading old books so much, you have to really understand what they're talking about. You know, because nest eggs, like, who has a farm or a chicken coop? I mean, more people than they used to.
Yes.
In some ways. But, like, what's a nest egg? You know, oh, you know, so it's like stuff like that. And it's funny, like, some of my friends, because I have a lot of artist friends and people who are drawers, and they talk all the time about how drawing is a different kind of attention than taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a different kind of attention, but I don't think it's a better kind. I mean, it might be a slower or whatever, but I think there's something about taking pictures, because I love to take a lot of pictures too. I think what's fun is to just have like an arsenal, just a tool belt, just all these different ways of paying attention. And if you can ask yourself, what am I not getting? You know, like, what am I deficient in right now? Or like, it's kind of like when you're hungry. If you think about what sounds really good, it's usually that's what you need in your diet. You know, if you really kind of think about, you're like, oh, salad, I should really, you know, like, if you ask yourself, like, spiritually or mentally, like, what am I kind of missing here? Then you can kind of look at your tool belt and say, well, maybe I should do, you know, maybe I should take a walk or something. With all that said, it's like, so much of this stuff is subconscious. You know, you got to kind of train yourself. And then you do a lot of it on autopilot. It's not like I sit around in my office like, oh, I think it's walk time. It's like, that doesn't really happen.
Yep. Somewhere in the book, I don't remember which chapter, but you quote Kurt Vonnegut saying, you know, just write a poem and tear it up, you know, and something in what you just said reminded me of that line.
Yeah. And Vonnegut's daughter was really funny. She was kind of like, yeah, you first, Dad. You go first, you know, because she was kind of goofing on his idea. And I use it because I do think it's true. If you could write a poem knowing that you were going to tear it up, that'd be great. Except Vonnegut wouldn't have torn up his poem. You know? That was what his daughter was joking about, which I love. But I do feel like if you can do things for the doing, it's so hard now because it's so easy to share things.
Yes.
And I think, you know, one of the problems that young writers and artists and creative people in general have is that they haven't really known. I mean, if you're under a certain age, you don't really know a world in which making and sharing were separate.
Hmm.
You know, because now it's like if you make something, you can take a picture of it and put it on your Instagram immediately.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a kind of merging of making and sharing where it can get very heavy if you're trying to make while thinking about sharing.
Yes.
You know, there's something about you need to be in the making state and not thinking about the sharing state. Well, we've all been under surveillance so much and self-imposed surveillance. I mean, we all have, like, so many people have Instagram accounts, and I wrote a book called Show Your Work, so it's not like I'm, you know, I've contributed to this idea that if you want people to know about your work, you have to show it to them, you have to share with them, and in a regular frequency and in a certain way, but you can't really do a lot of really good, raw, new, scary, interesting, creative work if you feel like you're under surveillance. And I think part of the problem with having an Instagram or a Twitter or blog or newsletter, all these things that we have there, such wonderful tools to build audience and connect with audience and get our stuff out there and run our lives, you know, you kind of have to forget all that stuff or be able to tune that out in order to get to that raw kind of creative state. You know, I am a completely amateur piano player. I have tried to do Instagram lives before as like just fun. Just like, I'm gonna jump on Instagram live and play some Debussy. Just as like a fun thing. And every time I do it, I can't believe how much worse I am. Because I'm so like,
Yeah, totally.
Oh no. You know, even though there's like 40 people on there, all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, you know, because I'm not a performer. And performance is a whole different thing than like writing in the studio or composing.
Yes,
you know, performance is a whole different thing. And so I think about that all the time, how it's like, you know, if you think all the time about if I'm drawing, I'm like, what's this going to look like on Instagram? You know, that's very limiting.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to have happen to you, you know? So to try to like get away from the surveillance mindset, to try to get away, to disconnect from the world so you can connect with your work, that's something that every creative person, and I would argue any human living today,
yes,
really needs to figure out. You know, how can you disconnect so you can connect with yourself?
Agreed. I think that is so true. And I feel really fortunate that, I don't know how long it's been now, a decade maybe? Maybe not quite that long ago, that I sort of with music went, you know what? Like, nothing's going to happen with this. This isn't going anywhere, and I'm just not going to care about it going anywhere. And it's easy to say that sounds like I just did it and it was over, right? I'm talking about a process here.
Right.
But when I reemerged on the other side of it, and I just played the guitar, and I don't even anymore very often even record like a good idea I have. You've got a chapter called Forget the Noun, Do the Verb, right? It's forgetting about being a guitar player and just playing the guitar, but it's turned that into a true source of solace and joy in my life, because I really have no agenda on it except that, like, it's very satisfying. Now, in our show, we do all the music breaks, so the music shows up in there, but, I mean, that is, like, the lowest form of, like, yeah, who cares? No one cares, you know? I mean, and most of what I play on guitar never does, but it's just nice to have something like that in life. And I loved something you said in your book. I've been talking a minute here. I'm going to shut up and let you talk in a second. But you talked about making gifts. You know, you said, we're now trained to heap praise on our loved ones by using market terminology. The minute anybody shows any talent for anything, we suggest they turn it into a profession. And boy, that really hit me as so true, because when I let go of the guitar as something that might get me something, it became a solace. But that's not the way we are oriented in today's world at all. We are all taught, if you're good at something, do more of it and sell it.
Anything worth doing is worth doing well, or, you know,
or
professionally, or on stage. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is something I learned too late, I think, you know, like, I was lucky in that I sort of knew that the musician's life wasn't going to be for me. Like, it's funny because I used to say, like, I don't know, getting up in front of an audience every night and trying to bear, you know, that sounds too hard. And now, of course, you know, like, a big part of my job is like getting up on stage and talking to people. But for me, it was like I got lucky because I kind of like knew music wasn't going to be a thing. And so it happened to me, like, that's suddenly became the hobby.
Yeah.
And hobby has become such a pejorative term now. Oh, it's just a hobby. He's just a hobbyist, you know. And at different points in time and in different cultures, I mean, hobbies are what make life kind of worth, you know.
Yes.
I mean, the English have a much different approach to hobbies, for example. There's a really wonderful essay by George Orwell that he wrote during the war. And he said that one of the reasons he felt that the English had resisted fascism was that they were very fond of personal hobbies, things like gardening or puttering around or tinkering. Orwell really thought that one of the reasons that the English people were good at resisting fascism was because they practiced hobbies. If you think about America right now, I mean, everyone's trying to professionalize.
Yeah.
Everything is a side hustle or, you know, whatever. And I, particularly with creative people, it's like most of us have tried to turn our hobbies into professions.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes very, very, very important that you find another hobby.
Yeah.
You know, that you find something outside, whether it's gardening or, you know, like whittling, I don't know, whatever it is. That thing that you can do for no reason.
Yeah.
You said something so beautiful. It's like, once I stopped looking at my guitar as something that could get me something, you know, get me something.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it, really. You know, like that's it. Once you stop looking at the thing as something that'll get you something, then something can happen, right?
Yeah.
Like, then you can really make something happen. And I do, though, I think the way out of that market mentality is to make gifts. You know, like, if you're a painter and you're really feeling, I think, like, painting something for your mother or something, or you make something for a hero of yours who's been dead for 200 years or so. You know, just getting into that idea that I'm going to make something for someone else and I don't expect anything in return. I'm going to take the gifts they've been giving me and then I'm going to, you know, pass them on, because that's really what the gift is about. And there's a great book about that called The Gift by Lewis Hyde, where he talks about, like, all really great art has a gift element, and that someone's brought to their gifts from the gifts of others, and then they pass on that gift through their work. So if you can kind of like just pull yourself out of that market thing for a while, long enough to get in touch with that gift again and to kind of grow it, then you can kind of like get back in the game. Or you can just pull it out completely. You know, you can just say, I'm not doing this for work anymore. I mean, if you have that luxury.
Yeah.
You know, and there have been multiple artists throughout history who have said, no, I'm going to work at the post office and write at night, or I'm going to,
yeah,
you know, I'm going to become an insurance vice president of this insurance company, and then I'm going to write these wild poems. And, you know, poets, it was very helpful to me as a young man to look up to so many poets because they all had day jobs.
That's right. Poets, yeah. Yeah. By and large.
There's never been any market in poetry. And so they've been able to kind of stay pure in a sense.
Yeah. Well, I really related to that. Not that creating a podcast is exactly a deep art, but it was my love. And, you know, when it became something that went from something I just did because I loved doing it to something that pays the bills, there is a real change there. And I consistently have to sort of do what you're talking about, which is like, how do I get back to what started this? What was the fire that was here?
Yeah.
You know, like it takes work to get back to that place.
You know, I mean, I've been thinking a lot. My kids went back to school, and I've been thinking a lot about teachers and just how many teachers. I talk to a lot of teachers, and they all, you know, you have to be passionate to do that, because you are not going to get rewarded in a way that is commensurate with what you do, especially in this economy. There are so many professions that happens. You know, you're brought to it because you love something, and then it becomes your breadwinning, and like, how do you get through that? That's a big part of the job in some ways. And very few of our jobs train us in that, you know, how to recover some of that joy, how to recover some of that early energy, some of that rawness. You know, you're obviously a musician. I'm a musician. So it's fun to think about how musicians do it. Mick Jagger jumping on stage at a bar. You know, it's like a musician, you know, jamming.
Yeah.
Prince used to, when he was on tour, you know, he'd just show up somewhere and play. You know, he'd do his big show at the arena, but then he'd show up somewhere, you know, do a set and then leave immediately, you know, because he just wanted to play.
Yeah. Can you imagine sitting in a bar and Prince walk in and climb up on stage and just blow the roof off the place? I mean, it would be unbelievable. The guy was so talented. I just think about, like, it would be mind melting to see that.
My friend's name is Matt Thomas, and he was a Prince fan long before I was. And Matt saw him on his piano in a microphone tour.
Mm.
And I just think, like, oh man, that's a big regret of my life, not going to see Prince when he was here on the planet. So yeah, but I mean, you know, it's finding those things in your life. How can you just practice? You know, it would be like if LeBron did a pickup game in Akron or something. You know, whatever it was that, you know, to try to go back to that. And to recapture that, I just think a lot about energy these days. Like, one of the things I love about art and books is that I feel like the good stuff, it's embodied energy. There's some sort of energy that's been like locked in the piece. The reader, like with books, really good books have a kind of energy to them that is activated once the reader comes and opens it up. It's like the reader has to breathe life into it, and then all of a sudden it like works again. And all that energy that the writer put into it, it'll be there forever.
Yeah.
Like when you pick up Moby Dick, whatever weird, dark, crazy energy Melville channeled into that, whoever picks up Moby Dick and opens the page, like, it's there for them.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is part of the magic of art, and it's what really sustains me in my rougher days, is trying to find, you know, I've got books around here where it's like, okay, I need some of that Linde energy, you know, I need some of that Thoreau energy, I need some of the Hockney energy, you know, it's like, go to it and it's there for you.
Yep. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up with thinking about the energy that's embodied in great works of art. Austin, thank you so much for coming on the show. You and I are going to continue in the post-show conversation. And what I really want to talk about is a chapter title called Demons Hate Fresh Air, which is such a great idea. We'll talk about that in the post-show conversation. Listeners, if you'd like access to that, as well as a special episode I do each week called Teaching Song and a Poem, and all the other benefits of being a member, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. Austin, thanks so much for being here. We'll have links to all your work in our show notes, and I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you. It was really fun.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a monthly donation to support the One You Feed podcast. When you join our membership community with this monthly pledge, you get lots of exclusive members-only benefits. It's our way of saying thank you for your support. Now, we are so grateful for the members of our community. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their support, and we don't take a single dollar for granted. To learn more, make a donation at any level, and become a member of the One You Feed community, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.